You're listening to Civic from the San Francisco Public Press. On this edition, while the city is dealing with the deadly COVID-19 pandemic, the truth is more people have died from drug overdose deaths this year than from COVID-19. It's due to a potent opioid flooding the city streets.
Part of what we're seeing is a lot of overdose deaths that are fentanyl and stimulants, fentanyl and heroin, fentanyl and benzodiazepines. And those might be cases where the patient didn't necessarily know that they were getting fentanyl. They thought they were, say, taking a benzodiazepine or a Xanax bar on the street. That might not be somebody who's used to having any opioids in their system. And so that would be somebody who even a very small amount of fentanyl could potentially cause an overdose in, because they just don't have tolerance.
This is Civic.
Civic is underwritten in part by the San Francisco Foundation, which has been acting as a catalyst for change to build strong communities, foster civic leadership, and promote philanthropy in the San Francisco Bay Area since 1948. More at sff.org.
I'm Mel Baker, sitting in for Laura Wenis, who's on assignment. The death toll has gone past 570 and the worst pandemic to hit San Francisco in decades. It's killed people of all ages, races, and classes in neighborhoods across the city, and more deaths are expected over the coming months. I'm not talking about the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm talking about drug overdoses in the city. And the 570 are only the numbers we have from the Department of Public Health through the end of October. The number of people who have died of COVID in San Francisco since the pandemic began is, as of this taping, 167. I don't want to play down the COVID numbers. DPH Director Dr. Grant Colfax has warned that the death toll could soar as high as 1,400 in San Francisco early in the new year as we wait for the vaccines to slowly roll out to the general public. For those dying of drug overdoses, there is no vaccine. Treatments are challenging, and resources are limited. To talk to us about how the overdose crisis in San Francisco is being dealt with, and the greater Bay Area challenges as well, is Dr. Hannah Snyder. She practices primary care and addiction medicine at Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital and is an assistant professor at UCSF. She is co-principal investigator of the California Bridge Project and the director of inpatient services at the center. Dr. Snyder, welcome to Civic.
Thank you so much for having me.
First, can you tell us a little bit about what the Bridge Project is?
Absolutely. So the California Bridge Program is an initiative to help patients across the state with opioid use disorder get help. We work with a medication that's called buprenorphine, brand name is Suboxone, which we know stops people from returning to drug use and saves lives. This is an incredibly powerful treatment. But for so long, you could only get medication for addiction treatment like buprenorphine by getting on a long wait list and showing up at an appointment and jumping through tons of hoops, and very rarely patients would access treatment. And historically, hospitals and emergency departments didn't treat people who use drugs very well, so people were really afraid to come in and admit use. But we see this as a really big opportunity, and so in the California Bridge Program, we've decided that every hospital in the state of California should be a 24/7 welcoming access point for people who use drugs, where you can come in day or night and say you want to cut back or quit on your opioid use, and we'll help you. We'll get you started on buprenorphine right away, often within an hour or two, and then we'll get you linked to ongoing life-saving treatment.
Yeah, that's very true, because I know around other parts of the country, they very much treat buprenorphine almost as if you're trying to get on another drug. The hoops that people have to go through are insane, and there are treatment facilities that refuse to give them to it, as if abstinence only is the only option. And of course, that means people go through these horrific withdrawals. And yet the research shows that this is a very effective way for people to do this transitional phase to get off of opioids, which are so deadly.
Right. The reality is that buprenorphine and methadone as well are life-saving medications, and that people are just much more likely to stop using opioids, including heroin and fentanyl, when they're placed on one of these medications. They may be on it for a short period of time, or they might be on it for years to the entirety of their life, and that's okay. I think of it in much the same way as I think of a diabetic who might need insulin. In a perfect world, somebody's going to do diet and exercise and not need any insulin. But we know that many people with diabetes do need insulin and they need it for years, and that's okay. And in the same way, buprenorphine is not substituting one addiction for another. It's a life-saving medication, and it doesn't cause euphoria and it doesn't cause symptoms of addiction. It really just helps people stay well and stay away from drugs that really put their health at risk. We know that this medication works. We know it's hard to get. We know that less than 20% of people nationally who are eligible for this, for these medications are on them. And we want to do whatever we can to make it as easy as possible for people to stop using when they're ready to do so.
So let's put this in context. As I understand it, at least 70% of the tremendous opioid deaths that we were mentioning earlier come from specifically fentanyl overdoses.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. You know, particularly in San Francisco, we've been working so hard for so long to reduce overdose deaths. And we've really been at the forefront of treatment and of harm reduction for some time. And so we were able to keep overdoses, you know, relatively under control versus some other communities. But lately, with the rates of fentanyl contamination and the COVID pandemic, we've just taken such a hit. And our patients are really seeing this and struggling with this. There's fentanyl contamination, not just in our heroin, but in pain pills on the street, in Xanax pills on the street, in cocaine, in methamphetamine, and plenty of people are using straight fentanyl as well. And we know that this has just such a higher risk of overdose death than substances that folks were using before.
I remember being incredibly puzzled by this when I first read about this occurring, because you would think fentanyl, first of all, this was a drug that was really only known by anesthesiologists years ago. It was something that was used for extreme pain. It was used in the operational setting. It's a drug that has to be created in a lab. I would presume that it was fairly difficult and complex to produce. So you would think it's not something that's going to show up on the street. Heroin is a drug that's created from plants. It's something that that's fairly easy to create. How on earth did fentanyl become not only something that is widespread, but that is so cheap that it is actually used to cut stimulants in other drugs, and that it has become this tremendous menace?
Well, I don't pretend to be an expert on the international drug trade, but the reality is that fentanyl is fairly cheap and easy to make. More so than heroin, it's in small quantities, so it's easier to transport. And to be honest, some people really like using it. And it's just, I can't emphasize enough, this is a whole new ballgame. You know, we used to be dealing with heroin or dealing with opioid pain pills, and then we started progressively seeing fentanyl contamination of the existing drug supply. But now we're really at a point where a lot of folks, particularly in San Francisco, are exclusively and preferentially using fentanyl. And there's a couple different reasons for that. Part is that it's just cheaper than heroin. And so if you're using a fair amount every day, sometimes fentanyl is a cheaper way to stay well and to avoid withdrawal. Some folks feel that the potency is better known from fentanyl. They'd rather not be surprised by fentanyl contaminating their heroin. They'd rather know that something's fentanyl. And some people are even using it sort of as a harm reduction mechanism, in that they know that it's easier to smoke fentanyl in some cases rather than injecting heroin. And so sometimes people are using really logical steps to arrive at the conclusion of wanting to use fentanyl rather than heroin. But then the reality is that the overdose risk is high, and that when people are on fentanyl, and particularly high amounts of fentanyl, it's just a lot harder to stop than people who are taking pain pills or lower amounts of heroin.
Can you go into that a little further? Is it just that they miss it, the dosing amount is so small, and that you can just miscalculate? I mean, when an anesthesiologist is doing this, they're doing it in micrograms. They're doing it in very, very small quantities measured in a clinical setting. Is it just that they miscalculate the amount, or kind of explain that?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of what we're seeing is a lot of overdose deaths that are fentanyl and stimulants, fentanyl and heroin, fentanyl and benzodiazepines. And those might be cases where the patient didn't necessarily know that they were getting fentanyl. They thought they were, say, taking a benzodiazepine or a Xanax bar on the street. That might not be somebody who's used to having any opioids in their system. And so that would be somebody who even a very small amount of fentanyl could potentially cause an overdose in, because they just don't have tolerance. And then we're seeing that some people are intentionally trying to use opioids, but there's more fentanyl in it than they thought. They didn't know there was fentanyl in it, or maybe it's a more potent fentanyl analog. There's a lot of different things that can happen out there. You know, we know when you're an anesthesiologist, you know exactly how much of what drug you're drawing up. People who use drugs work really hard to take harm reduction steps. They'll use fentanyl test strips, and they'll try a tester dose before they take a larger dose, and they make sure they use with somebody else. And even with all of those harm reduction steps, it's hard and it's scary, and sometimes overdose happens.
And this can also be, must be made harder because you're, the outcome is you're trying to have an experience of euphoria. So delaying that, just in the same way that somebody that's drinking something, the tendency is to, you want to get to that second or third drink. It's hard to delay yourself. So doing those careful steps is more challenging, right?
Yeah, Mel, that's a great question, and it's a good point. I think that's often true for some people, but we have to be realistic about the fact that later on in the course of somebody having an opioid use disorder, somebody having an addiction to opioids, most people aren't using to get high, to feel euphoric anymore. People are just using to stay well. You're using because when you don't use, you go into withdrawal, and it is like the worst flu you could possibly imagine, and you're vomiting and you're having diarrhea and you have a runny nose and you have aches and pains. And what you're doing is you're trying to use a little bit so you can get out of that state, so you can get back to feeling normal.
So let's talk a little bit about the clinic you work in and how you try to help people manage either working through harm reduction with continuing to use substances or to work through with buprenorphine or other efforts to try to manage the course of their substance use disease. Kind of talk about how that worked before the pandemic and what that is like now.
Yeah, absolutely. So I work in a variety of different settings. I work inside San Francisco General Hospital on a consult team that does addiction treatment. And I also work outside the hospital in a clinic at what we call the Bridge Clinic. So sort of affiliated with that statewide program we were talking about before. I think a few different things have changed. First and foremost, it's gotten harder for people who use drugs. The risk of COVID has increased for people who use drugs, just like for all of us. And with the isolation and the financial strain that everybody is facing, I think some of us have turned to an extra glass of wine in the evenings, and many people who use drugs have turned to using additional substances. At the same time, access to treatment has gotten a lot more challenging. A lot of programs have shut down. A lot of shelters have shut down or restricted access. And so people are really struggling right now. We've been lucky in that the federal government has made a couple changes that's made it a little bit easier for people to access treatment, knowing that these barriers have come up. So, for example, prior to the pandemic, I was never allowed to do phone-based prescriptions for buprenorphine. And that was explicitly forbidden, and you had to meet a patient face-to-face before you could do any prescribing for them. Now with the pandemic, there's been a recognition that just really doesn't work, that we can't see everybody face-to-face. And so we've been able to access some additional people as a result of that. So one really great example that's come out of that is that people who are experiencing homelessness, who are at risk for, or who have been exposed to COVID or who have contracted COVID, have been placed in these isolation and quarantine hotels, right? And because of the ability to use telehealth, we've been able to treat those patients, get them on buprenorphine if that's what they're interested in, and link them to ongoing care if they're interested. And so both COVID has put a huge additional strain on this population, but it's also opened up some doors for more creative treatment than we were able to do before.
Now, also, what about naloxone and things like that? If some people are isolated, whether they're in an SRO, they're in their apartment, they're on the street, but they're using separately to avoid COVID, and they aren't able to use with somebody around, and they do overdose, and there isn't anybody to give them naloxone. I never can pronounce that properly. To counter the overdose, what is that? Are you tracking that? Is that proving to be a real problem?
So in medicine, we're always tricky with our names, right? There's a one medicine called naloxone and one called naltrexone, and they're related, but they're different. It's very confusing. So naloxone, which is the same as the brand name Narcan, is the overdose reversal agent that we use. And we have seen a lot of difficulties. Obviously, we've seen a huge increase in both fatal and non-fatal overdoses. And many people are isolating, as you point out, and so they're not able to use with other folks like they used to. There's been quite a few different efforts that have been going on in the city and county to try to counter that. So first of all, the DOPE project, which is an amazing program, has really stepped up distribution of naloxone. There's naloxone stations in the shelter-in-place hotels, the isolation and quarantine hotels, single-room occupancy hotels. They're being widely distributed in encampments and to people experiencing homelessness, because we know that naloxone in the hands of people who use drugs is the best way to prevent overdose. You can give as much naloxone as you want to healthcare providers, but we're often not there. Right. So we've stepped up a distribution of naloxone. There's also an incredible service out there that's called Never Use Alone, which is actually a hotline nationally that people can call if they're using and they can't be with somebody else. They will actually call 911 for them if they do have an overdose. So there are some different steps that have been taking to that have been taken to decrease that risk, but it's absolutely very real and it's something that we're thinking about all the time.
So how would that call in work? So the person calls, they talk to the person, they create a little rapport with them, that person gives their address, and then they say, okay, now I'm going to be using now. And they say, okay, I'm going to stand by with you. You're going to talk to me in the next couple of minutes and stay with me. And I know you're going to be okay because you're going to continue to talk to me.
It's a really interesting and innovative harm reduction service. And we actually called the line before we started distributing the number just to kind of check it out. And the person who answered the line was a mother who was a nurse and who had lost a child to overdose. And just a really sweet, lovely person who would stay on the line, get the person's address, talk to them, and ensure that as they continued to talk, she knew that they were okay. And if the person stopped talking or stopped being able to communicate, they would call 911 and send an ambulance to that home. So it's just one of many different innovations that folks are trying to take to really fight this overdose problem. But I think first and foremost, it's get naloxone into the hands of as many people as possible, and particularly people who use drugs.
So if a person is alone, if they're falling into an overdose, there just simply are no options with that.
It's a very real problem. So we do in regular times encourage people to use with somebody else, use with a buddy. And even now we have to weigh the benefits and risks of being together with a person, the risks of COVID, but the benefits of overdose prevention. The other things that people can do are fentanyl test strips are really widely available, so people can test their drugs to see if fentanyl is present. And then, like we talked about before, people can take really small doses when they first get a new batch to check and see what is the potency of this substance before they take a full dose. Those are other steps that people can take to prevent overdoses. And I guess the other thing I'll say is that there are many people who overdose because they feel really significant withdrawal, just like you were saying. They feel so sick and they want to take a dose. They want to feel better. And so one of the best things that we can do is ensure that treatment, including buprenorphine, is available whenever people want, wherever people want. So anytime a patient walks into a syringe access point or an emergency department or a clinic or you name it, if they're at all interested in getting started on buprenorphine, we should be offering that to that patient because that's the most important thing that we can do to actually prevent overdose.
I'm speaking with Dr. Hannah Snyder with the California Bridge Program. So housing is, of course, the primary concern to help anyone dealing with an addiction problem, but how far away are we from having enough other resources in the way of treatment facilities, outreach workers, health providers, and the like, to be able to bring this, really pandemic of its own under control?
It's a great question, and it's a hard question. I mean, I know that statewide and nationally, there is absolutely a deficit in the number of people who are able to prescribe buprenorphine, in the number of syringe access points, in the number of naloxone distribution centers. In San Francisco, in a lot of ways, we're very lucky. We do have access to many prescribers. We have good naloxone access and we have good syringe access. But one of the most important things that we're working on here in San Francisco now is making sure that that access is equitable, because we know that overdoses disproportionately impact BIPOC populations, and particularly older African-American men. And so there's a lot of work being done in the city right now to target that group and make sure that they're able to get all the interventions that everybody else is.
One thing I noticed in looking through some of the recent data is the perception is that the majority of people who are overdosing are unhoused. And that's not true. A lot of people are housed. They are in apartments. They're in at least SROs and things. How should the public take all of that in and realize that this is an issue that affects everybody and we need to figure out how to be treating all of these communities in addition to focusing on the communities that aren't getting any support, as you just mentioned?
Yeah. No, it's such a good point and it's such a good question. I mean, addiction impacts every community. It impacts almost every family. We can all think of loved ones who have struggled with addiction. People experiencing homelessness often have more visible substance use disorder, but that's because they don't have a home. And so if they're using, you might be able to see it. But that shouldn't take us away from understanding that that all communities experience addiction, all socioeconomic groups, all racial groups experience addiction. What I think is clear is that for people experiencing homelessness, for minority communities, for folks with lower socioeconomic status, for rural communities, there are certain groups that have a lot more difficulty accessing treatment. And so what we want to do is we want to make sure that treatment is available to everybody, regardless of which of those groups they may fall into, and that it's as easy as possible for people to access that. So we shouldn't have barriers. People shouldn't have to jump through hoops. If you want treatment, you should be able to get it, regardless of where you're from.
Treatment on demand has been the sought after goal forever. But as I asked earlier, we seem so far away from ever even being able to do that, just having the resources to truly be able to have a place for people to go that are willing and ready to seek out treatment when they ask for it immediately and not be on a waiting list. Do you have any hopes that that's going to be something that can be changed? And are you hopeful that a new administration at the federal level may bring resources to bear on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I am hopeful. I mean, I think in San Francisco, we've done a lot of work to increase access through street medicine teams, through syringe exchanges to give treatment on demand. But through California Bridge, one of the things that I'm most proud of is that we really have successfully brought treatment on demand to over 50 hospitals in the state of California. So what we see is that somebody can show up in the emergency department at 3 a.m. on a Saturday and say, I'm ready to stop using right now. We can get them on buprenorphine within an hour. And we can get them feeling good and feeling normal, and we can get them an appointment for a follow-up visit in 2 days. And that's really revolutionary. I mean, with that, we've had over 5,500 patients who were started on life-saving medications. And we've seen that a large proportion of those folks engage in ongoing treatment after that fact. And so I think the emergency department and other non-traditional places of care, including syringe exchanges, are what we need to be focusing on now, because we know that traditional treatment structures are hard. It's hard if you're somebody who's actively using drugs to say, okay, well, I have an appointment in 2 weeks at 11 a.m. I'm going to make sure I show up for that appointment, and I'm going to show up and with my insurance card and with my ID and all these other things. That's not realistic. But saying no matter when you come into the emergency department, we'll take care of you, we'll give you a smiling face, and we'll give you the medications you need, and we'll also give you some naloxone in your hand when you walk out the door, that is accessible treatment, and that is a way to bring treatment to everybody.
One question I think a lot of people probably have is the perception has been that if you use law enforcement interventions, somehow you can drive the cost of narcotics of all kinds high enough that you will make it impossible for people to be able to generate the money to be able to purchase these substances, and then that will force them into treatment. That has been an experiment, the war on drugs, that's been tried endlessly. It doesn't seem to have worked very well. It doesn't seem to have worked at all. And you mentioned that fentanyl itself is actually quite cheap because dealers simply flood the market with it. So this seems to be a completely broken model, the idea that somehow you can use market forces to drive people into treatment. So if that's the case, is there a role for law enforcement at all in some kind of drug interdiction to help with some sort of other societal pressure to assist in this, or should it be solely and exclusively a medical treatment problem?
That's a great question, and it's a tricky question because you're right. The war on drugs has failed. We've tried this. We've tried policing people out of using drugs. We've tried incarcerating people out of using drugs, and it just doesn't work. In our current system, I think people have a lot of fear of law and enforcement. Historically, people who use drugs and people who are in law enforcement have not had a healthy relationship, and there's not a ton of trust there. And so it's hard to use that as an entryway into treatment. But that being said, in some of our California Bridge communities, we have had our substance use navigators actually pair up with special law enforcement groups and go out into the community and work together with law enforcement to offer treatment and to bring those patients into the medical system and to bring them into treatment. I think that's hard, though. I think that's an uphill battle. And so what I think is important is that first and foremost, we use safe spaces, places where people who use drugs are comfortable, as an entryway into treatment. And at the same time, I think it's really important that we educate law enforcement and that we partner with them wherever possible. But I think we have to acknowledge that there's such a fraught history there that simply working through law enforcement is not going to fix this issue.
And so the economics of drug use for somebody who is has substance abuse disorder and needs to have these substances, they have to generate a certain amount of money every day to purchase these substances to avoid illness. How does that work? How does somebody who has to, and of course there's a huge broad range, many people are still employed. Some people are on various social service situations. Some people are homeless. How does that impact their health, having to generate and use a certain amount of their income to feed the addiction?
I think you're right. I think there is such a broad spectrum, right? So there are people with very highly paying jobs who use a lot of opioids. And there are people who maybe engaging in some illegal activities in order to get funds to use drugs, and everything in between. And so I think it's hard. I mean, I see some folks who are using drugs and who feel comfortable with where they're at and say that the cost is not too much for them. But one of the most common things that I hear from my patients is that one of the reasons they want to stop using is because it's just so expensive. And because it's really hard to, you know, get food and get shelter and get drugs all at the same time. But for each individual person, that's such a different story that we essentially just want to make sure that people who use drugs get access to the treatment they need and also get access to food and housing. And however we can do that is, I think, one of the most important things we can do.
Anything else you'd like to add about this issue and about where we are right now and what we should be doing differently?
I mean, I think the reality is that addiction is multifactorial, but it's a chronic illness, and it's a chronic illness that we should be treating and welcoming people as they come into medical care. And people who use drugs are really good people who are often stuck in really challenging situations. And so one of the most important things that we're trying to do here at San Francisco General and at the California Bridge Program is be kind and decrease stigma and just make it as easy as possible for people to get the treatment that they need and for people to stay healthy and well in the long term. And that's the most important thing I think we can do.
Dr. Snyder, thank you so much for coming with. That was Dr. Hannah Snyder with the California Bridge Program. You can learn more at bridgetotreatment.org. I'm Mel Baker. You've been listening to Civic.
Civic is underwritten in part by the San Francisco Foundation, which has been acting as a catalyst for change to build strong communities, foster civic leadership, and promote philanthropy in the San Francisco Bay Area since 1948. More at sff.org.